Gleich geht's los mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast. Hier kommt die ganz kurze Werbeunterbrechung und unser Werbepartner für diese Folge ist Synology. Und jetzt denkt man so, warum Synology im On the Way to New Work Podcast? Okay Leute, ich habe hier ein Briefing, vergesst es. Warum? Weil ich benutze selbst Synology. Synology ist ein Technologieunternehmen und zwar das Unternehmen macht Hard- und Softwarelösungen im Bereich Netzwerk. Klingt total langweilig, aber ich veröffentliche momentan 3 bis 4 Videos die Woche. Dann haben wir noch den Podcast, das heißt, wir haben unfassbar viele Daten. Trotzdem, wer On the Way to New Work kennt, weiß, ich bin hier der Cloud-Hans. Das heißt, ich kümmere mich immer um diese Frage, wo wird was hinkopiert. Was wir haben, ist eine NAS, eine im Prinzip mehrere Festplatten, die man zusammenschaltet von Synology, die hier lokal steht. Dort werden die Daten von unserer Riesenkamera raufgespielt. Synology Backup, das innerhalb dieses Netzwerks, innerhalb dieser Festplatten, innerhalb der NAS. Ich kann von verschiedenen Rechnern drauf zugreifen und schneiden. Und dann kann ich das Ganze, und das ist das wirklich Geile, im Hintergrund bei mir in die G Suite laden, geht aber auch mit Office 365 und habe alle Daten in der Cloud gebackupt und dort auf der NAS zum Schneiden. Das ist das, was sie halt machen. Und wir haben immer mal wieder Themen gehabt, weil wir was neu aufgesetzt haben. Die haben einen wirklich guten Service, auf den wir uns verlassen, einen sehr guten Support, gerade wenn es auch um Wiederherstellung geht und so weiter. Läuft alles ohne Lizenz und Gebühren, weil man eben die Sachen kauft, einrichtet, laufen lässt und dran schließt. Klar, ihr zahlt natürlich mit G Suite und so, aber darum geht es ja nicht im Kern. Also, ihr bekommt unter der E-Mail-Adresse newwork@synology.com individuelle persönliche Beratung für euer Unternehmen. Wirklich großartig, wirklich cool, wenn man es an die Cloud anschließen kann. Das ist jetzt mein ganz eigener Pitch hier für unseren Werbepartner. Jetzt viel Spaß mit der neuen Folge. Welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast. It's Christoph Magnusson today. Michael couldn't make it, but I'm here with someone who Michael met in Los Angeles, Dirk Albon from Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. Thanks for being here. You just had a speech. We sit in the Audi Max of the University of St. Gallen and try to fake that it's just the two of us having a podcast. It's not.
Should have gotten a better couch to start with.
So there are some people in the background listening to that, but that's perfectly fine. I just listened to your presentation and understood a bit better what's behind the idea of the Hyperloop, the idea of how to change transportation, but more important, the different way you guys work and organize the work. Before I would love to jump into that and discuss with you, we had so many, we had enough time and so many ideas when we started talking. I would love to know you a bit better. Like, how did you become the person who you are today, starting from Berlin over Italy to the States?
Wow,
you have time.
Who am I? I think that's the first question, right? We all have. I wasn't as lucky to go to university. I grew up in Berlin. I just did what's called Realschule, right? So even though I was on a gymnasium before, but I actually decided I needed to work. And so I made the bright decision to go into banking. Finished that a little bit early because I needed money. And I don't know. As soon as I started working, I felt terrible. Because, you know, when you go to school, there's always an objective, right? There's always something to do, like the next exam, graduation. But once you start working, that's it. It's like, so you're, you know, I had a pretty good job, and I was thinking, okay, so now I have to come here every day. And I go on vacation once or twice a year. I just have to buy a house, find a girlfriend, maybe get a dog, get married, have a kid, retire, and die. I was 18 at the time, so it freaked me really out. And so I came home one day, and you know, they throw these newspapers for free into the letterbox, and you know, there wasn't like an announcement in there that said, looking for sales agents in Italy, even without language skills. So I called, and basically, well, they said, well, just come here and try it out. So I took all my vacation, went down in a train, and stayed. And basically, I was selling cleaning products door-to-door commercially, so for bars, restaurants, and you know, it was an interesting experience because I definitely learned how to sell. I also learned that I could only sell something I really believe in. I really enjoyed being in Italy. It was really interesting to have this mix from this German mentality over to the Italian one. So I then, well, I came back to Germany, but with intent to going back to Italy for good. And they had, it was just the beginning of the European Union, right? So they had this program called European Year for Young People. And it allowed you to have to do a, I think it's called a stage, right? And learn Italian. I didn't need to learn Italian anymore. I knew enough for enough more than I would have learned in those courses. But I thought, well, a stage might be a good way to go down there. And so I had to work for free for like a year in a company. So I went to this company and said, okay, look, my intention is to stay here. So I'm going to come, I'm going to work for a year, but you're going to hire me afterwards. And they said, yeah, of course. And I said, okay, but you're going to not pay me like an Italian. Because at that time it was like 500 or 600 euros probably was the equivalent that you would get to work in Italy. I was like, I can get that in Germany without working. So, you know, I come, I work well. If I work well, you're going to hire me and you're going to pay me. They said, yeah, of course. So I started working in the export department. And before the year was over, I actually had an offer from another company. They wanted me. Turns out that they weren't very serious. So they wanted me to, I don't know, it was just their business waste. What didn't really work with how the way that I work. So I decided to quit, and now I was in Italy without knowing where to go. And I had like a magazine in my car, and I was selling chimney flues at that time, right? So export manager for chimney flues. And there was one company in Milan. I'm from Berlin. I wanted to be in a bigger city. So I called them and I was like, hey, do you guys have an export manager? They said, no. Do you want one? They said, well, maybe send us a resume. So I went home, put a resume together, faxed it, called them again. Did you get it? Can I come by? And I literally, I think, either the same day or the day after, I had a meeting with the owner. And they hired me as a consultant. So I started working for them, and then from there, started to do my own companies in alternative energy, pellet stoves, fireplaces, solar. Did quite well in Italy, and then, you know, met my ex-wife. You know, when I was in America for work actually, and vacation, and we became pregnant. So I had to decide she didn't want to come to Europe. I wanted to, you know, I had my companies here, but at the end I wanted to give it a try. So I gave my companies over to my partners, left thinking that I would go there with quite enough money, because I had just bought a building basically, which was worth, I think at that time, something like 1.4 million euros. And I still had to pay 600 or something like that. So I thought, well, almost a million, I can live okay. Well, it was 2008. So the commercial real estate completely tanked. I kept the building as long as I could. It cost me 15,000 euros a month. So I literally, like at one point I was like, I can't pay this anymore. The bank took it. I went to America with 20,000 euros. Spent that within 2 months, by the way. well, I was used to a certain lifestyle. And well, and then basically was there without any money. It was a newborn baby, and you know, didn't my ex-wife, we didn't really know each other well enough, right? Because we only had vacation together, if you want so. So yeah, I started working in a startup company for, I think, $15 an hour, got a raise to 18. Was probably the most overqualified person there, because I was the only one who actually had a company before, or run a company. But it was completely new to me. Like, I was in Europe, and all my companies I've built up by selling, right? I sold a product, then got the product, and now I was, now they got, I don't know, $3-4 million, and the guy never even showed up. So for me, it was not understandable, right? So, you know, again, I was doing startups when it was still called, you have a company. Like, never, you know, startup was, I heard that for the first time basically in the US. So I saw, it worked a little bit different, and the company, this startup was actually, there was it was incubated by a non-profit incubator that was funded by NASA. So I got to, you know, I got closer to them and really liked the idea of helping others to start their business. I think that's my passion. My passion is really making others entrepreneurs, which is kind of also shown in our model, right? Because basically you have all these, you know, 25% entrepreneurs, if you want so, that they put in 10 hours a week to try out to be entrepreneurs. So I really was interested in that. And but of course, you know, the startup had some trouble, so they put me part-time, etc. So I started working as a waiter. At one time, I was working as a waiter in an Italian restaurant, as a manager in a sushi restaurant, and in the startup company, basically part-time. And in the evening, I was doing my own thing. So there was not really a lot of time left. That got a little bit better later. I started working for an Italian company as responsible for the US market. And then, but I still kept connection with a startup incubator, and I was helping them, and they had a lot of trouble. So I was thinking about how could we help entrepreneurs to build their companies without really necessarily needing money. If there's one thing that I hate, it's fundraising. So, you know, I always loved open source. And while I was working on my own company, I used a lot of outsourcing, right? So there were a couple of websites where you could hire someone for a couple of dollars on the other part of the globe, and they would help you. So I took all of these, some of the methodologies, and I came up with these new model, right? And this crowd-powered model where basically, you know, people can join and they work in exchange for stock options, but they're decentralized, distributed in some other other places around the world. Well, you know, and then we built a website basically in beta, and it's really not so much about the website, because I think the website sucks, by the way. Always did. Actually, it was beautiful when we launched, but as soon as we launched, we realized that the people that were going on the website wanted to do completely different things, so we had to break it. And later I realized that it's not about the website, it's really more methodology. So sometimes people call me and they're like, I want to use you guys, I want to, like, no, it's, you can use whatever you want, you just need to follow the methodology and just be open and talk to people. And if someone, if you explain someone your idea and they say, oh, wow, that's amazing, the next thing you have to say is just like, why don't you join me? Why don't you help me? And that already works. So yeah, so basically that's how the model started. And then as we launched in beta, literally I think a couple of days later, I heard on the radio Elon presenting the Hyperloop, and I said, well, wait a second, this could be interesting. And we had some relationships with SpaceX. Mm-hmm. So one of my co-founders, who died later in an accident, was actually was the director of IP management for the Aerospace Corp, which is a big research institute in the US. And he was at SpaceX, and he was talking to the president, Gwynne Shotwell, and about some technology licensing. And then he said, well, you know, we have this website. You guys were talking about the Hyperloop. Is it okay if we put it on the website? And I said, yeah, blast it out. And so we did. That's kind of, you know, so that's how we got there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know. I don't think that any of it has to do really with myself. I think that we are, like, Hyperloop today is where it is because of all of these people, right, that are investing their knowledge and their time. And it really started kind of like, you know, we were able to start a movement. So we were able to prove the model, which is really exciting.
That's what I just learned earlier today. And thank you for sharing the whole story, because it always helps to understand, like, okay, what are the different things that you experience in your life, the ups,
the
downs.
You could just cut, like, it in the...
No. There is no cut here. That's the one take. I never do two takes. So, but what I'm interested in, even more than the Hyperloop technology itself, which is crazy, you just presented it, what you guys are planning, and we jump into that, but how you organize that, because you are way more people than a usual company can actually bring in, and it's a completely different model than hiring people and giving them a paycheck. So you sell the idea and they work for you for a stock option, but, like, can you explain a bit more how the model works and how you organize the work?
So first of all, it's not much different than any other startup company, right? So if you think about it, when you start a startup company, people are coming together, they follow an idea, they work in exchange for participation in the company. If it goes bad, they don't get anything, right? So, you know, it's the same, it's kind of like the same approach. That mixed with some awesome methodology from open source, where basically you use platforms, you throw things out that people can do with little effort, where you use a little bit the crowd, you use these teams. That's really the model at the end. I think, you know, the one thing that was, that I realized and I thought is genius about the model is really that, you know, it's easy to change the world if you're a billionaire, right? If you're a Jeff Bezos, if you're an Elon Musk, changing the world, I mean, you know, here's 100 million, that just tries us. But if you're a guy who works as a waiter, right, and maybe manages a sushi restaurant on the side and is trying to do something, how do you do that? Or if you're a student. And I mean, this model really helps. Sometimes I go to talk to kids in elementary schools in LA, right? And it's just something that remained mm-hmm. impressed with me, so that's why I'm talking about it. So they don't, I mean, entrepreneurs today are rock stars. I mean, I did a presentation yesterday. I think there were 1,000 people in the audience. And I have friends that are literally rock stars. They have less audience than I have sometimes. So, and that's a great thing, right? But there's still a certain portion of the population that don't know what an entrepreneur is. So I asked these kids, do you know what an entrepreneur is? And they had no idea. I asked them, what do you want to be when you grow up? They were like, I want to be a dancer. I want to be a basketball player. I want, you know. A couple of Hispanic kids were like soccer player, but nobody said entrepreneur. So when I said, do you know what an entrepreneur is? They said, no idea. I mean, their only example of an entrepreneur is a drug dealer on the corner, right? That's literally, no, you're laughing, but they have a lot of entrepreneurial skills, right? Distribution network, marketing. I mean, you know, yeah. It's actually quite a lot. But so I was, my way of explaining them was like, well, you know, an entrepreneur is someone who solves a problem that he sees. And then I was asking them, what problems do you guys find? What do you find? What would you like to solve? And in a couple of classes, like a couple of kids were like, and these were, I mean, I think they were like 7 years old, up to 10. And a bunch of them were like world hunger. Like in each class, it was like, I want to solve world hunger. And I said, well, actually, you see, I actually believe that entrepreneurship is the answer to all of these things, right? If you can solve, in my opinion, world hunger, probably more easily through entrepreneurship than through charity. And when I heard them at the third one, I was like, look, pretty easy. There's another three kids over there that want to solve world hunger as well. So you guys just come together, you form a company, and you try to figure out how to solve world hunger, right? I mean, that's what an entrepreneur does. And that's by finding people that have the same passion. You don't need money. Like, when I talk to entrepreneurs during my time at the incubator, they're always like, I need to raise $50,000. I need to raise $100,000. When I was asking them, what do you need the money for? It was always like, well, I need to build an app. I need to build an algorithm. That's like the normal answer you get. Well, you don't need $50,000. You need a programmer. So, you know, if you find someone that is passionate about this and he has the skills, he has his knowledge, problem solved. Right? So you don't, and this can actually go much further. So in our model, I mean, again, we have 800 people plus 50 companies. So I would say like way over 1,000 people definitely to manage, but they actually come with their knowledge and what they, and their passion and what they want to bring to the project. So they work better than any person that you can hire. When you hire someone, most of the time, their first thought is the paycheck. Mm. In this case, their first thought is like, I want to make a difference. And you can see if someone works well or doesn't work well, and if they work well and you want to increase their opportunity to spend more time and you need someone in that specific position, you can bring them on board. So, you know, I mean, now there are several other startup companies out there trying to do the Hyperloop. We were the first one. But 2 years later, after we came out and said, okay, it's doable, there was another one. And they raised way more money than we did, $300 million. But like, if you look at them, first of all, what they have done, I think personally, of course, I'm partial. I think that we have done more or better, and we have more contracts where, you know, we have much more areas covered. We have the regulation, we have the insurance and all these things. But the one thing that stands out, I think, is that they're actually a mess. Like, you know, they started out as a typical Silicon Valley company, burning cash. There were a bunch of scandals, like never saw, like you've never seen even in Silicon Valley. People are constantly leaving. There's always an exchange. I mean, in our company, there's barely anybody who has left. I mean, of course it happens, right? But very little, and not in the key positions. So that's really the difference. And it's 5 years, right? So some people have been there for 3-4 years now. That's all, I mean, for today's standard, that's already a long time. And in a startup company, it's even longer. So, but that shows you really how much the passion makes a difference.
I'm an entrepreneur for a while, like 20 years, if you count in from school time and definitely after leaving here from university. And when you shared that earlier with me, I'm like, whoa. You just showed me a completely different perspective on looking onto entrepreneurship, because what one of the idea from New Work is the question of what do you really, really want to do? What do you really, really want to do in your life? And what you're doing is you're hiring people who actually put so much effort into, you say, like part-time job or full-time job, or even like say I buy in and I work for certain hours. So they really, really want to do that, obviously. So my question is, and I really have to think through that, because we have to make some changes to our company, that's for sure. Maybe even the university has to rethink some of the ideas here, but I've been studying here, I can say that. And it's a good university. How important is, of course, the idea and the concept of the Hyperloop, and then also the vision that you bring in with all the experience, all the package, all the passion behind it? Because you share that as it's normal and say like every company should work like that. That's, and it sounds easy and simple, and I guess it's not. How important is the idea, the vision, that stuff behind it?
I mean, look, this is the first company really that's working this way. So believe me, because it's my concept, right, I was able to stick to it. But it was hard. You know, especially when you raise a lot of money, because investors come and they're like, okay, I'm going to write you a $5 million check, but this crowd thing.
Take this away.
Yeah, it was nice so far, but let's become serious. Mm-hmm. because now we have money in the bank. And, you know, the answer there is, well, we are serious, and this is really what makes us successful. And at the beginning, I mean, even the media, right? The media writes, oh, they have volunteers. It's not, I mean, yes and no, like, they're not volunteers, they're professionals. Mm. Like, it's not a bunch of guys in a chat room. These are actually, I mean, we have, there might be five experts when it comes to magnetic levitation in the US, and I think four are with us, right? So, I mean, these, they're people that are, that have PhDs, that they're maybe retired, but, you know, they have an immense, like an enormous amount of knowledge that they can bring in and they can share with guys that just come out of university. So the value that we're having, the low cash burn, the opportunity to innovate, because I have people that come and they're like, hey, I'm an expert in artificial intelligence, or I'm an expert in blockchain, and I think that you should do this, this, this. We listen to it. If we like it, we're like, okay, how about we build a team and you try? Right? So even so, of course, the stock options have a value, and especially the investors want that we are using them well. You're not, you know, you're not limited in terms of your resources, because the way that it works is you're giving out more stock options, but people are bringing value. So as long as you're making sure that there's a value creation, the value continues to rise. And so you have unlimited resources. I actually believe that we could have built or done everything without any cash. But, you know, of course, once you have competitors and you have the need of going for investors, etc., things change a little bit. And maybe I'm a little bit too, I don't know how you call that, but too naive, I guess, right? Because I've always said we don't need money, we need brains. So, and I hear a lot of the times from the guys behind me and my management team, no, we also need money. So, but in real, I think the real value are the brains. I mean, we are probably the largest innovation effort in mobility that exists, and it's not. Again, it's not so much about me, like it's a structure, that lives by itself. You're an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. And the analogy that I always give is, you know, I was always feeling like I was pulling this wagon. Mm. And I had my employees that were on the wagon because I have the responsibility, but I needed to pull. I was the one who had to make sure we move forward. And every time I would hire someone, this wagon would get heavier, right? There was a point where, I don't know, I mean, you have all these responsibilities for these families, right? So you need to make sure that your company is doing well. Well, this is the first time that I feel that people are actually pushing. So, you know, like every entrepreneur, I have ups and downs. I mean, that's kind of part of life. You have really high highs and really low lows. It's normal. But, you know, when I have a low, there's people pushing behind me, and it's just moving. It's moving by itself. It's not about me. And it's amazing to be a CEO of a company and knowing that even if tomorrow there's no money in the bank, it doesn't mean that the company is over. It still continues. So, and that changes a lot of things.
It sounds like. And what I was thinking of is, do you need some big goal like changing the way transportation works, or does it work with other ideas as well? But I also want to like dive into the transportation part, but I have a lot of questions about it, also how it works, but let's first start.
I tried it with other things as well. I mean, of course, you know, it's the first thing people say, well, of course this works, Elon Musk. And well, we actually, I mean, on one hand, yes, it was definitely an advantage because you get, maybe you can use a little bit of the PR power. On the other hand, it's a downside, right? Mm. Because you're also always in the shadow.
And everyone connects Hyperloop to Elon Musk.
Exactly, which, to be honest with you, he has nothing to do with anything that has happened really over the last 5 years. I mean, sometimes he has supported the community with the SpaceX competition, but maybe that's more a hiring tool for SpaceX, and maybe it's a way also to stay in the media. But, I mean, it's been literally us, the other companies, that have pushed this forward, and But it was definitely an advantage. But on the other hand, can also be it has a negative side. So when it comes to other ideas, I mean, I've tried it and I've done it myself. I mean, I have some other efforts that I'm helping or supporting, and we're using the same model. Everything I do uses this model, and it works, you know, because you bring the people on, you're offering them something. I mean, if you're an entrepreneur and you tell someone your idea, if they say, that's amazing, again, you have to ask, you should tell them, join me. Do you want to be part of it somehow? Do you have an idea? And if they don't say, whoa, that's amazing, maybe you should rethink your idea, right? So that's as simple as it is. Mm. It's not about, doesn't have to be the Hyperloop. It can be something small, and you don't need 1,000 people. It can be, you know, 3, 4, 5. It doesn't make a difference. But being able to offer an incentive and being like, you're part of this, right? So I'm sure there's a lot of projects where you are super interested in, and if you would have the possibility to participate with something, you would.
Gleich geht's weiter mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast. Hier aber die ganz kurze Werbeunterbrechung, und Michael wäre gerne dabei gewesen bei diesem Einsprechen, denn es geht um Unternehmen, was ihm sehr am Herzen liegt, nämlich Dr. Wolf. Und der eine oder andere von euch wird jetzt sagen, kenne ich nicht, habe ich nie gehört. Doch, ihr kennt wahrscheinlich die Produkte, nämlich Alpecin oder BioRepair, also Produkte im Bereich Arzneimittel und Cosmetics in einem. Dr. Wolf ist ein Hersteller von Markenprodukten für Haar-, Haut- und Mundpflege. Das heißt, das sind die Produkte, die man eben nach außen kennt. Ganz konkret geht es aber darum, dass Dr. Wolf gerade versucht, diese Marken digitaler zu machen, also das Unternehmen zu digitalisieren, und sucht dafür Verstärkung in Bielefeld, also im Herzen Ostwestfalens, nämlich Data Scientists, Data Engineers, Head of Online Marketing, Junior Performance Marketing Manager und. Schaut mal rein, eine schöne Herausforderung, denn ich kannte das Unternehmen nicht so gut, ich kannte die Produkte, aber ich habe mich ein bisschen eingelesen und mal nachgeforscht und fand es spannend, mit welcher Haltung vorgegangen wird. Also weder zu ängstlich noch zu verrückt, aber trotzdem eben immer diese Gesetzmäßigkeit in Frage zu stellen und wirklich auf Forschung aufbauen, Produkte zu entwickeln. Fand ich gut. Das spricht eben auch dafür, dass Digitalisierung dort klar angegangen wird und eben auch konsequent durchgezogen wird. Wie gesagt, das ist mein Eindruck von außen, aber es lohnt sich bestimmt mal reinzuschauen. Es gibt einen Link dafür, der heißt omr.drwolfgroup.com. Wolf schreibt man mit 2 F, omr.drwolfgroup.com. Und jetzt geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work.
For the people who didn't listen to the presentation, and for maybe the people who then first thought, I want to join the company, in very short term, what was the vision behind the Hyperloop? And you've sketched some of the ideas and the concepts, how it could work. Could you just quickly give a brief overview of the most important things out there?
Elevator
pitch.
The elevator pitch. I've never been great with those elevator pitches. It's, you know, my mind is way too complicated.
Elaborate. Let's see. Like, I got the moment when you said there's actually no public transportation, no railway that makes money. They actually all lose money. I'm like, whoa. Is that actually true? I'm like, Googling.
That's what we see as blue ocean, you know. So, and I mean, most people, when they hear about Hyperloop, they get excited because they say it goes super fast. And that's definitely what helps. It also helps that it has been part of, you know, our childhood, right? We have been growing up with it. Futurama, the Jetsons, you've seen it in movies. There was a James Bond movie with it. But then narrowing it down and making it boring, if you want so, because at the end, it's not like a lot of people think you go inside a tube and you get sucked away. It's not like that. And personally, I wouldn't use that. But it's a really great way to move safer and faster. But more importantly, it can be profitable. So that's the real challenge that we set out from the beginning. When we found out that, you know, all the others don't make money, we were looking into technologies that we could be built and could be operated very cheap. Because again, during the presentation I said that all of these technologies already exist, and to be honest with you, there's probably 3-4 solutions for each of the problems. Right? There's different levitation technologies, there's different propulsion technologies, but and a lot of them are fairly easy. But building it in a way that it also makes economic sense requires you to do a little bit more research and maybe not take the first one. So a lot of the times, even these tests that you see from the Hyperloop, where it's like, oh, it goes, oh, we achieved, I don't know, 400 or 500 miles an hour. That's nothing impressive because you don't want to use it that way anyways. Like if you're accelerating on a mile really, really fast, do you want to sit in that? No. It's about having a steady acceleration. You're getting to a top speed. That's kind of like the result of the technologies that you're using. But the main achievement is to make it so that your operational costs are very low. And, you know, of course, that's very boring for a lot of people. So, you know, saying that you're from Zurich to Berlin in 40 minutes is a little bit more exciting.
Without all the airport getting in the lineup, exactly. Security and so on. It's a big thing to change because you have to change the habit of people when it comes to transportation, and especially from governments, I'm pretty sure. So, like,
I don't think the habits change. One of the things that we looked into from the beginning was to keep it very similar to what you already know.
How would it feel like, let's say, if I want to travel from Zurich to Berlin?
The same way it feels right now. I mean, you don't feel speed, you feel acceleration. So if you've ever been on an airplane going to the US, right? So when you went to New York, you probably went around 1,000 kilometers an hour. How did that feel? Right? So you don't feel that.
Yeah.
You feel the start, you feel when you land, so acceleration, deceleration, and that's something that you regulate. So based on the route, we have comfort is always the most important part. So, you know, it's not about getting as fast as possible somewhere. And a lot of people don't understand that because they think, well, but, you know, you can't go 1,200 because you have to go on a curve. Well, okay, if I have to go on a curve, I go slower.
Mm.
It's about the average travel time. It's about, you know, again, a low operational cost. So in general, I think the biggest opportunity here is actually something completely different, because the Hyperloop itself, technology is not that big of a problem. I mean, of course, you need resources to integrate everything. It's a big challenge because it's a huge infrastructure project, so it's not easy to get done. So it takes this movement to make that happen. But the real opportunity is that we can rethink transportation. So rethinking how would transportation look in 2019, I think that's the part that excites me. So if you are, you know, if you're in the train industry or in the airline industry, there's so many barriers where you don't even continue thinking in a certain direction because you already know, oh no, that's not allowed.
Mm.
But when you're building something like the Hyperloop, everything's allowed. It's a white piece of paper. So we can literally redraw from zero. And I think that's exciting.
Sounds like a big opportunity. What do you think would be the first country where you would say I can use the Hyperloop by just driving there, going in the train, traveling somewhere else?
So right now, as I said, we are building in Toulouse, our R&D center. So we're putting the whole system together to do all the integration and optimization there. We already started the design process in the Emirates. We have two commercial agreements right now. One in Abu Dhabi and the other one in China, in Tongren. Both of them start with a shorter line, 5 kilometers in Abu Dhabi, 10 in China, and then we extend once the certification is done. Again, nobody is going to deploy billions of dollars for a system that doesn't have the regulations in place. So you start with a smaller part. It gets all the safety records done, and then, you know, you can extend.
And the idea, you also sketched that, is to make money beyond the ticket, let's say, using the travel time, so the time people spend in the Hyperloop for marketing, for example.
Yeah, so personally, I believe that this time can be used much better. So I spend a lot of time inside a plane. but I'm six. I was 16 hours the other day on a plane, and you know, you're inside these cars for hours, and the time is not well used. So if you think as transportation as a marketing, so you know, to get you to basically, you get me, you have me now in this place. I'm a captive audience. What are you? What can you do with me? Right? So through data, I can tell you who I am, what I like, where I'm going, when will I be where. And if now I open that up and I tell people, build services for me, like create me something, like give me something that I can do. Maybe I can book something when I arrive. Maybe I can get something delivered on the next station. Everything can be timed. Or I can have an on-demand professional joining me. You know, I mean, believe me, if there would be a masseuse on those flights, I would get quite a lot of massages. But, you know, there's none. They're not trying to entertain me by making money. So, you know, I don't even know what those services are. Like, all I know, I mean, there's the obvious ones, right? Virtual doctor visits or even physical doctor visits. Maybe you can get your nails done. I mean, there's, but I believe that the moment you're opening it up to, you know, the general public, and now they have access to those customers, they are able to come up with completely new kinds of services that you haven't thought of. I mean, you know, if you come back from an international flight, maybe you don't pick up your luggage because someone else picks it up for you, dry cleans it, and brings it to you the next day, right? So there are all these possibilities that we're not using today and that can actually save us time once we get home.
This is like, to me, there are so many problems you take or challenges you take at the same time, and the technology itself, building it, the infrastructure. So bringing together all these partner companies and all these people, can you give a little bit of background? How do you actually organize it? Even tool-wise, you mentioned earlier in the talk, you have self-developed tools. How do you collaborate with all these people at the same time?
Well, it's a challenge, of course.
I can imagine.
And one good thing at the beginning was that, of course, one thing we're not missing is manpower.
Yeah.
Right. So you could find people that can do certain tasks, because it's quite used to be quite laborious. And after, like, or still slowly, we're integrating tools that take away certain tasks that we have to do. But in general, the way that it works is that people and companies are getting stock options for each hour they work. There's different tiers, so based on qualification, but it's kind of like a salary. So of course, someone who just comes out of the university doesn't make the same money as someone who has been a PhD in magnetics for 30 years. But it's really not so much about it. And I also believe that the people are not necessarily motivated, at least at the beginning, by the stock options. Of course, once you're making progress and you're raising money and there's value, they are getting interested, right? So because, of course, now they have amassed a certain amount of value, and there's quite a few millionaires actually in the company, so people that have been working with us from the beginning, and at least now on paper, based on the company valuation and the stock options that they got, actually, you know, have reached over a million and worth. But it's not for them, it's not about that. So they're getting for each hour a certain amount of stock options. They're normally organized in teams, somewhere between from 2 to 7. Somehow there's like a limit. If you have more than 7, people don't communicate well anymore. At the beginning, I actually thought, well, there's a problem, let's throw as many engineers on it as possible. That doesn't work. So it's much better to have smaller teams and maybe have them work on the same problem even without knowing that they are competing or existing, rather than having a lot of people. So inside these teams, they normally have one leader. And we tried a lot of things out there as well. So sometimes this leader developed. Sometimes we had to nominate him, right, or put him inside. And that's still a challenge, like figuring out what makes a team successful, like because some teams work amazingly and others, not that great. And it's part of the self-motivation. And I mean, if you have really good people, they work well if they're far away or if they're close. It doesn't make a difference. But you know, putting together the right team with the right characteristics, that's still, it's exciting to try to figure that one out.
And you're quite spread out. I mean, you're...
They're anywhere. Right. So different time zones, different countries, different languages, different cultures. So it's quite funny. And the thing that actually excites me the most is when they meet. Because sometimes you have people that have been working together for 2 years, right? They've never seen each other. And now you bring them together, and it's like they're best buddies forever. It's amazing because they know each other for so long. There's quite a bond. It's really incredible. Sometimes, you know, there's even a need to meet physically. I think it's a good thing to meet physically, but it's not always necessary. So, you know, you can get quite far with a distributed team. And to be honest with you, as an example, if you're able to work with the best designer, even so he's in Japan, rather than with a mediocre one that lives around the corner, it makes a difference.
How do you personally keep an overview of like what is happening?
I don't. I mean,
I like that idea.
Well, first of all, the way it's impossible when you're building a structure like ours and it's so big. That you want to be involved in everything is an error, right? So if you want to scale, you need to delegate. So there's an operation team, and so there's a little bit of a hierarchy. We try to keep it fairly flat, but there are teams that are meant to make sure that those teams are that they're reaching their deadlines. I mean, I'm traveling mostly around the world. You know, I'm the CEO. I'm like the number one salesperson for the company. That's my job. And so I'm the one who meets with Putin or with Erdogan or with Merkel or whoever they put in front of me. And, or I'm doing these things, right? Just spreading the word and maybe putting together some strategic alliances or talking to investors. A big chunk of my work is the strategy of the company, right? So where are we going? What are the things that may be a little bit more important than others? Not in the core technology because that's kind of set. We're building the tubes, we have the levitation technology, etc. Everything that's all, if you want, so done. So it's more about I'm like the person that's 2-3 years out. What comes after? Or the passenger experience, these kind of things are more what I spend my time on. However, we have some tools that help to have an overview. We build something that we call Lucy. Lucy is a little bit, I mean, the idea behind Lucy is to have artificial intelligence together with peer-to-peer control. So it's an email that basically goes out to all the team members once a week, and it says, hey, what have you done this week? And they answer. They also say how many hours they have spent. After a couple of days, a copy of a report goes out to all the team members in that specific team. So, you know, you might be lying one time, but if your team members, they know how much time you really have spent on the work or what would be normal. So there's a little bit of this peer-to-peer control. But it also allows us to figure out what are the blockers. What are the things needed? Because a lot of the times, you know, people tend to make up excuses, right? They say, oh, well, I didn't do this because I was waiting for this decision and nobody was telling me, so I didn't do anything for the last 3 weeks. Well, with Lucy, we have an overview. So we know how much time you have spent, we know what you were doing, we know what you're waiting for. That helps us a little bit to get an overview. So I look at it, I get a copy of all of them, but I just overflow them, right? So it's going into the details is not really my job, let's put it this way.
I like that, but I'm afraid we need to make a separate video of that because if I look at Max here in that direction, usually I'm the timekeeper, and since I don't see my podcast device, we're hitting the 45 minutes, don't we? Okay, but I always have two very important questions in the end. Number one is, what would you recommend? I think your kids are around the age of
8 and 9.
I think one of the youngest podcast listeners is around 10 or 11. What would you recommend someone at that age today?
Go out and play. I mean, sorry for...
No, you know, it's...
But in general, I mean, I remember being 10. I don't even know if I remember it, but, you know, I had a good time. So, and personally, I mean, actually, it's not true. I had a good time a little bit later. When I was 10, I was a computer freak, right? So I had a modem and I was on the internet before there was an internet. So you would still dial into other computers. And then the Deutsche Telekom, they switched their billing process from one flat fee to, I think, a 6-minute intervals. And my dad got the bill, and that was the end of my...
internet career.
Yeah, I always tell him I would have been an internet millionaire, billionaire, but, you know, he was too cheap. So he cut the phone line that I had laid into my room, and I went out and played basketball and, you know, had fun. Which worked out well as well. So it's not, you know, I think it's great to follow your interests, to learn things, but being out there and making your experiences in the world, sometimes putting the phone away or the iPod or the iPad, is probably it's what I'm trying with my kids at least.
And do you read? Do you get inspiration from reading?
Actually, I don't read. I listen. And I used to read quite a lot, but I don't have the time anymore that much. So it's much easier for me to do audiobooks. Mm-hmm. But I do quite a lot of that, yeah, actually. And you get a lot of inspiration. I mean, it's amazing, right? So there's someone who has been working 40 years or like has experiences of a whole lifetime, and you can just take all of their experience in a couple of hours in a book. So I think it really opens up. I listen to a lot of TED talks, or there's actually on Spotify, there's a podcast, I don't know, but there's a podcast about TED talks, so the TED Radio Hour. So I listen a lot to that. I think that's super interesting as well and gives you a lot of new perspectives.
What are some of, like, give me three books that you can recommend listening to?
Well, give me the directions. So
it can be anything. Like that's what I usually ask people. And if you can imagine, like from 110 podcasts we did, it's like completely diverse.
Okay, so well, one of them actually see this, the marker, right? So and it's the first time probably in 10 years that I bought a real book and a marker. And it's a book that I listen to, and I think it's amazing. It's called The Courage to be Disliked. And it's not a business book. It's a philosophy, psychology book. I don't know, have you ever heard of it?
Not yet.
Do you know who Adler is? The psychologist Adler?
Not top of my mind, no.
Well, it's Adlerian psychology mixed with Greek philosophy. And it gives you a lot of perspective on life, and you know, it's a very interesting book. You should definitely read it.
I know what I will order right now after the podcast.
It's really amazing. Others, I mean, mostly I read business books, so this one is a little bit different. But it shows you, like, it talks about the meaning of life, the possibility of change, and you know how we use things that happen to us and how you can, you know. So it's a really interesting book. It's translated from, I think, Japanese over. Adler, of course, was an Austrian psychologist, but it's an exciting book. Another one, I mean, my top ones in the business world, besides biographies that I always like, and I like biographies because when you read them, you realize that those people are just like you, right? So, and we all don't have a clue. You're just somehow in this position and now you got to run.
and keep going.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're here, and have you ever heard of the imposter syndrome?
Yeah.
Have you that problem? Do you have that problem?
I am not sure.
No.
I'm not a psychologist.
Well, no, I mean, the imposter syndrome basically is like, basically everybody, right? Everybody that's on stage is like, well, I hope they don't find out that I'm just normal. And I shouldn't even
I realize that from YouTube videos. You make a video and then you think like, well, that's what I always do and it's nothing crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
Will someone find out?
I get these things where people like journalists come to me and they're like, so you made it, right? So can you tell us? I'm like, I didn't know that I made it, but okay. You know, you just have, yeah. I mean, you try. But, and especially like in our case, it's really not so much about me. I'm the lucky one that can sit here, but it's more about the whole mm-hmm. effort. I mean, I wouldn't be anything about without all the other people. But so biographies, I think, help you to realize that Steve Jobs was just a normal guy and maybe even not the nicest one, right? That that Jeff Bezos really, and a lot of things, didn't have really a clue, but got lucky with some mm-hmm. and others were the right intent. I mean, so that's why I like biographies. Then there are things like, what was the name? I should pull out my phone right now, but, Contagious. Have you ever heard of Contagious? Mm-hmm. Contagious, I think, is a really great book. It's about why things catch on and what makes them viral. So the psychology behind it. I actually like psychology quite a lot.
That's what I figured by now, yeah.
Well,
that's,
you know,
good recommendations. It's I also didn't have the TED Talk list top of my mind, that they have a podcast way to listen to the TED Talk. So
it's pretty amazing. So, you know, I think psychology is understanding why we do things mm-hmm. and how we do them. And another one is the like switch. So apparently mm-hmm. I'm not likable, so I have a problem with that. So trying to be like, understanding how that works, right? So communicating with other people is, I think, very important as well, and understanding how they work and how you can use different approaches, I think, is very important as well.
Thank you so much for the time and for these insights.
Pitch anything is another one.
Okay. We can continue with it, Liz. I definitely liked that conversation with you, and it gave me a completely different perspective on the whole idea. So thanks a lot for being in the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.